Welcome to the Holden Village Podcast. Holden is a community of education, programming, and worship located in the remote wilderness of the Cascade Mountains. These snapshots provide a glimpse into the learnings taking place in our community. Let's tune in to this week's highlight.
My name is Jeff Kersengrip, and I'm a professor of communication at the University of Portland. I use he, him pronouns for myself. At the university and in my work, I specialize in interpersonal and intercultural communication, especially as it's applied in instruction. So I know a lot about teaching, especially teaching across barriers. How do you develop a repertoire that works with the people immediately around you? It doesn't relieve the need to also work on systems beyond your own circumstances in classroom, but it is a kind of expertise that we can apply today. I've been here at the Village this year. I've been talking about communicating science in public and in private. So our early sessions were talking about, you know, what does that even mean? What is it? Who are science communicators and what are they actually up to? What I want to do in this podcast is really just spend a couple minutes framing some advice that we're talking about this week that has to do with communicating science, both when it's just a matter of translating complicated ideas for listeners who don't know those complicated ideas, or receiving those ideas yourself. That's also communication interesting, right? It's not just what we exhale, but also how we inhale. Then to focus on, and we'll spend most of our time in this podcast focusing on, how do you navigate tougher waters when you're communicating science with folks who are perhaps resistant to it, or they want to challenge you about it. That's the more fraught situation, especially when it's people you love, people you've known for a long time, people with whom you have relationship. That's really where we'll be focusing much of today, is how do you talk to those folks in your life who are counterfactual in their thinking, and what to do so you don't make that worse, and in fact, how might you make it better? The sessions this week, if you decide to listen to them, we talked in the first session just about science communication, what it is, what the challenges are actually, and we really identified there's at least four challenges to communicating science, regardless of whether you're facing a tough audience or not. One is that it's taking place in a complex context. It's always happening where individuals, groups, societies, organizations are both the communicators and the audiences, the listeners for science. So nobody's really purely just a broadcaster anymore, and nobody's purely just a receiver anymore. We're all kind of contributing to those conversations in ways that are more complicated than they used to be, mostly because of social media. And a lot of, for example, science reporting has gotten more interactive and has let people into the scientific process sooner than it used to. So we talked about some of those challenges to do with context. We talked about audiences having sometimes not a good understanding of particular science or even about scientific method itself. That lack of familiarity can create some misunderstanding of science that they come across, scientific conclusions or conversations. Third, the nature of science itself really can complicate things, that we use certain methods as scientists to understand the world, and they are unlike the ways people typically think on a day-to-day basis, and the ways scientists communicate about their work also are unusual and sound more tentative than the scientists actually feel about their conclusions. The norms in science reporting have a lot of caveats in them. And finally, there's sort of a common deficit model thinking about science communication. That is, that the scientists actually know what's going on, the science is unchanging, and the people listening just don't know enough. So if I could just be clearer and louder and keep repeating myself, that'll be enough. It's a deficit way of thinking about science communication, and it's not very effective. Partly because the next session we looked at a bunch of forces that are affecting how we are dealing with empirical realities. Everything from psychological skewing that we do, cognitive biases. We humans aren't made for objective thinking. We are made to survive. So our perceptions really are designed to keep us safe in the world. We're pretty easily triggered by some things in the world. We have a pretty complicated system of biases just built into being human. So we looked at everything from cognitive and psychological biases through, for example, some of the things that happen in communication itself that tend to skew how we understand the things being communicated, all the way up through socio-historical forces, ideologies, and narratives that we take for granted that drive a lot of our scientific questions and yet are themselves unquestioned, the norms for science and media journalism, research institutions and funders. Those folks are having a hard time too. So we talked about some things to do with communication that also have to do with how people understand the science being communicated. We looked at socio-historical forces, ideologies, and narratives, but there are science and media and journalism norms that also are clouding how it is that we make sense of science that we're interacting with. And then there are the research funders. There are folks whose money is driving the agendas that drive both media coverage and policy. And all those things influence science communication and our ability to process. So it's a really complicated dilemma that we've been talking about this week. We spent a day talking especially about representation in science and how that's also impacted and impacting these various forces and people's ability to connect with science. Who is a typical scientist? What sorts of things are explored in the world? Which sorts of things are not explored scientifically? What sorts of methods are considered normal to do? What sorts of takeaways do you think we're going to have from science? We're thinking about science communication really in two acts. One is an act where it's really just got some science that we have done, conclusions we've drawn based on scientific inquiry, scientific method, and it's complex, and we want to be sure that listeners who aren't part of that world can understand it. So we know some things about doing that kind of communication, where I'm just trying to share the findings, increase appreciation maybe for science, to increase people's knowledge and understanding related to a specific issue maybe that needs a decision. It helps to think about all scientific communication is having at least three characteristics. One is you're always thinking about it in terms of persuasion. It seems like you're just informing people. But in actuality, when you're doing science, you really are thinking persuasively. It'll come across as information for people. But you'll craft clearer communication if you think about it not as simply a sharing of information, but that you're also trying to do that persuasively. So we know we have logic to work with, we have credibility to work with, we have emotions and values to work with. Those are the traditional rhetorical levers that are part of any kind of science communicating. So that's one sort of key. Another one is to be clear. So in science communication, we are really challenged to be clear, especially around things like numbers. For example, Dr. Ellen Peters at the University of Oregon's Center for Communicating Science is a decision psychologist who focuses on people's innumeracy and how it is you have to communicate in ways that navigate the fact that we aren't very good with numbers. There are some things you can do both as an exhaler and an inhaler of science that will help you understand that aspect of scientific communication rather than just be intimidated by it or miss out on it. And finally, aside from being persuasive, aside from being clear, it's really important to remember that all science communication is storytelling. If it's effective, you need to bring to bear all of the tools of storytelling and think about how do I frame this as a problem and a solution, that the whole dilemma has some value and some merit for the audience that's listening, not just for anybody, but for the audience that's listening. What I want to focus on with this podcast, though, is to think about where you can go when you are confronting not just situations that require you to be persuasive and clear and a narrative, a storyteller, but that you're also facing circumstances where you're meeting some resistance from folks. People maybe are wedded to counterfactual things in the world because they are tied up with their identities, that it's important to be a certain kind of person and to feel like you are in a certain kind of relationship with other people. And that's really what's at stake for folks when hanging on so closely to things that are not true in the world. There are conspiracies in the world, and there are things that are not true in the world. But when you're dealing with things that are established via scientific consensus, the overwhelming amount of scientific evidence fits the claim that's being made. Those are things worth standing up for. And so we need some tactics to help people hear those to the best of their ability, especially when those are people that we love. And especially when our goals aren't just about sharing the excitement of science or helping people make a decision, but maybe the goal is to try and influence people's opinions and behavior and policy preferences, especially around things that would benefit the greater good. Maybe that's the goal of some science communication. So you might also have a goal to engage all of society's diverse groups so their perspectives about the science, particularly on consequential and contentious issues, matter and have weight in seeking understandings and solutions to those problems that affect everyone. These are more complicated scientific goals, and the audience also is much more complicated, again, especially when it's an audience that you love. A couple general things. One is to think about adapting to your audience. It's important not to speak to the other folks as though they're you. Really speak to the other folks as though they are the people they are, because that's the only way you're going to reach them. And there's good advice about that. How do you have better political discussions, for example, is a nice place to go for that. And also, rhetoricians have a long-standing set of scientific consensus about hostile audiences. How best do you approach hostile audiences? So we know some things about what to do with your goals in those circumstances. You know, aim for really incremental change. Pay attention to your own image in that situation. Your own credibility matters more than it usually does. Think about how you're ordering the information that you're offering and what sorts of information you're including. Pay a lot of attention to how you are treating the opposition and your audience, whether they're present or not. That respect really is important in those spaces. Thinking about what to actually do with folks, especially folks who are people with whom you are close, especially if they aren't showing signs of being unstable or violent, right? That those are special circumstances. But it really is important to know some tips about then how do you approach folks who are close to you and yet are being counterfactual in their thinking. I'm going to offer 8 tips here. These are taken from science reporting in various outlets, including NPR, the BBC, New York Times, All Science Reporting, and especially communication scholars Dr. Danigal Young, Dr. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who also is the originator of the PolitiFact fact-checking site, but a longtime rhetorician and scholar of this kind of work. To the best of our knowledge at this point, these are some guidelines that work best. One of eight is really to keep calm if you can. And that includes trying to use phone if you must, but face-to-face if you can, but kind of avoid social media threads as a place to talk to your relatives. And also know when to walk away. You can engage if you feel like you've got some kind of kinship or to be a lifeline to this family or family member or friend, and if they're not just too far gone. So that's one thing. Create circumstances that let you keep calm, even if the other person is not necessarily keeping calm. It'll have an effect. Second, and really important, don't be dismissive, don't be scolding. Do your best to be gentle and compassionate and patient. People adopt conspiratorial thinking because it aligns with some core facet of their identity. And we'll all defend our identities, right? We like to be the people that we are, and we will push back against people we think are telling us we aren't the right kind of people. So let your messaging be compassionate, be patient, be gentle. Those belief systems aren't about the information within them, but they're about the identity and the emotions that are appealed to through them. And that's really the level you're tapping when you manage to be gentle and compassionate. Acknowledging that the world feels pretty crazy right now and that all of us are a little confused helps, and that somebody who's an effective defender of science is going to listen to a person's reasons for having whatever beliefs they have without questioning their competence, their goodwill, or their intelligence. It can be a challenge, but it's a challenge worth taking. People change their minds when they're listened to. 3rd of 8, make it about protecting your neighbors. For example, say out loud the things you agree on. When you run across places where you can name spots of agreement, do that. For example, you might show around COVID-19 that millions of U.S. Americans have vaccinated safely. That's reassuring for people to know that some of the fears that have been pushed out into the blogosphere over time have not actually come to pass. It's not that they may, maybe they still will, but it's still worth pointing out what's available in the world. 4th, sometimes you can gently encourage some critical thinking. So aside from keeping calm, not being dismissive or scolding, being gentle and compassionate and patient, saying out loud things you agree on, that can buy you license then to do a little bit of offering of things that help them crack their own narratives a little bit. For example, you can offer conversion narratives from other people. People like them, people who used to be in the camp that they're in and who have changed their mind about something, and their stories that they would find credible, that they could consult, you could offer them. So it's also important to know that, to ask them where their own information is coming from and to help them hear messages that you're in favor of from sources that they trust. For example, their friends, their relatives, their doctors, people who are already wary of authority. Many folks who are counterfactual are also pretty wary of authority. If they knew how social media platforms really work or how much money they generate, they'd be more wary. And so those are the kinds of things you can introduce by, you know, asking a question like, whose interests does your online engagement serve, actually? So there's a way to sort of, by listening and asking careful questions, you can get people thinking harder about the sources of their own information and maybe offer them some other information. In fact, that's the 5th guideline, is you can share your own findings. That's our temptation, right, in these conversations, is to do that first, is to say, well, here's what I know. If that means you aren't calm or gentle or compassionate or patient or looking for places to agree, that stuff's going to bounce right off. And you've kind of lost your chance to get that into the conversation. So share your own findings, mainly just when they relate to places of agreement that you've noticed with the other person. It's a way to introduce some cognitive dissonance into the thinker's framework, but only once they're sort of remembering who you are to them and places that you agree. It helps sometimes to acknowledge for them that some conspiracies do exist, but note that those almost always play out in a certain way, that once they're exposed, they unravel quickly under media and legal scrutiny. And if that hasn't been happening with something they think is a conspiracy, even though it's been argued in the public for years in some cases, that should get their attention, as maybe it's not a real controversy. Maybe it's just a narrative that somebody is using for some reason that suits those people. One thing that's a caveat for you, though, is to think about If you're crediting scientific evidence and argumentation, be cautious about where you are crediting you got that, because folks have been schooled to be wary of certain sources of information. And if you align yourself when you're sharing your own findings too closely with articles that are aligned with, for example, media outlets or think tanks or something that folks have been schooled to be wary of, that doesn't help you. They might then dismiss you in a way that they wouldn't dismiss you otherwise. Three more. These are things that are attending more to kind of how to move the conversation forward. You've gotten in this space where you have created a relationship, you created an environment, and you've been able to maybe get some of your own conversation in there, or maybe not. But one of the ways you can help move forward is to rally around solutions, rally around enablements. That can sometimes shift a conversation from adversarial to more collaborative. Hark back to those things you both want. And just focus the conversation around what do we want and how do we get there? And that lets you sometimes set aside some of these pieces that are challenging. You can set aside some topical roadblocks, right? You can change topical lanes if you like, if they're kind of driving you down cul-de-sacs that get you off the main road. Keep your destination in mind and keep thinking about what sort of solutions am I after here. Total conversion is pretty unlikely in a conversation, so you really are kind of limiting what you're up to something narrower and smaller. So 7 and 8, really, the last two pieces of advice here have to do with thinking mostly about yourself relating to the other person. One is to ask genuine questions. Constantly fact-checking conspiracy theories with another person, for example, can really harden their views and often backfire. There's something called the backfire effect you could look up if you're interested. But it's also a quick way to get exhausted and to give up, is if you're constantly just trying to attack the logic of the conspiracy theory you might be wanting to talk about. So instead, asking genuine questions tends to be more productive. That's a seventh piece of advice. Help the other person feel heard and feel comfortable. We sometimes confuse being heard with being loved. I mean, being listened to has a really powerful effect. And so the longer you can keep yourself in a genuine listening space, not a fake one, you're earnest, you can ask open-ended questions, they build trust and they open the door for dialogue with the other person. But importantly, they also tell you more about why they believe what they believe. You don't get to learn that stuff if instead you're just exhaling at them. So develop your ability, both attitudinally and skills-wise, to ask genuine questions. Finally, come at them with unconditional love, as hard as that is. And sometimes that means reminding folks of the pre-existing bonds that you have. If this person is a close friend of yours, say that. That tends to get lost in the scariest parts of our mind when we're having difficult conversations with people that we love and care about, that we can forget those kinds of pieces. And it's important as a skilled science communicator to keep those things in the conversation as appropriate. If your goal is to bring them back and to reconnect, that accountability is something that should be put aside for a while. You don't have to make them accountable for their views. If they are willing to connect with you in a way that's a little warmer than it was before the conversation, maybe that isn't the time to sort of call them out for the vitriol, maybe, or just the stuff that's been propagated in the name of whatever conspiracy theory they might be espousing. Put that aside for another time. Remember, overall, that persuasion's a long-term project. Know that you're planting seeds. You're not visiting the grocery store and going to be able to harvest something right away from those aisles. You really are just kind of reminding them who you are and listening closely and letting them kind of parse the bits and pieces of their own logic together. And often the conversation will go in a direction you'd like, but it's a hard conversation to force in that direction. I wish you luck. I wish you well. These are things we can only do from one end of the conversation, but they are things that tend to spur the conversation to move in a more productive direction. Again, especially with people we're close to when they're dealing with counterfactual bits and pieces. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information or visit our website to find out more about the Village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.